Today on the 21st Show, the emotion of fear is an important force in American politics and partly responsible for our deep divides. As voters go to the polls, we are taking a step back from day-to-day politics to talk with noted Chicago philosopher Martha Nussbaum about fear and what the lessons of history can teach us about how we might overcome it. We'll also spend time on the subject of one of Nussbaum's more recent books, Justice for Animals, about what she argues is humankind's collective responsibility for the rights of all Earth's other animals. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is Election Day. The polls are open across Illinois until 7 this evening. We spent the first part of the hour yesterday talking with an official from the State Board of Elections about some of your last-minute questions. You can find that at our website, 21stshow.org. Beyond that, we've spent the last several months talking about different aspects of what's at stake this year and what's been happening in different parts of the electorate. We've had conversations on Project 2025 and abortion and immigration and trade and the economy. We've talked about and with Latino voters and Black voters and South Asian voters and the growing gender gap between men and women. We've talked with Democrats and Republicans and people who are running as write-in or third-party candidates. Again, you can find all those conversations and many more at our website, in our podcast feeds, or on YouTube by searching for Illinois Public Media. But today, I want to take a step back from the day-to-day back and forth of politics and talk about something deeper, and that is fear. Fear is an animating force in American politics. Democrats fear the consequences of Donald Trump's potential re-election to the White House. Republicans fear whom they think Kamala Harris would and would not represent if she's elected. Of course, the subject of fear in politics is nothing new, but the way it's being deployed this year as a campaign tactic is striking.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country.
When I've thought about the events that generated fear this year, the terrorization of immigrants in Ohio, the attempted killing of former President Trump in Pennsylvania, and the next planned shooting at one of his golf courses, when I've tried to process the through line of everything happening this year, I keep coming back to a book I first read at the end of 2018. It's called The Monarchy of Fear: A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. The book takes a deep look at how fear operates in politics, both in our present age and in the distant past. The philosopher of the title is Martha C. Nussbaum, a distinguished and longtime professor at the University of Chicago. The Monarchy of Fear is one of more than 24 books she's written on everything from ancient ethics to animal rights. I spoke with her by phone on Friday from her home in Chicago. Martha Nussbaum, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be talking to you.
I found your book, The Monarchy of Fear, to be full of mind-expanding revelations when I first read it and on rereading it. And one of them comes at the beginning, where you trace the origins of fear in our individual lives to what I guess I would now call the traumatic experience of being born. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean, in fact, there I was quoting Lucretius, so it's an ancient idea that namely, everything in the womb is all peaceful, and suddenly we come out into a world, as he says, the infant lies naked on the ground in need of every kind of life-sustaining help. Well, you know, we suddenly realize we're hungry and thirsty and cold and wet, and only others that we can't control can bring those things to us. And so, you know, even though those thoughts are not conceptualized very, very much, they're there in some form. And the problem is the baby needs others, but has no way of talking to them, asking nicely for help. The only thing they can do is yell and just hope that the person supplies something in response to the yell. And so I guess the idea is that there you get not only the fear of being abandoned, but it also a certain strategy, namely bossing other people around, and that these have, they could be matured into real adult reciprocity, but they can also stick around in adult life so that people end up thinking, well, I'm afraid, I just, either one of two things can happen. I want to throw myself into the arms of some all-powerful source of support who can take complete care of me, or I can just order other people around and be the autocrat myself. So the roots of all kinds of autocracy and excessive dependency on autocracy are, I think, born in infancy.
And I guess that answers how it lays the groundwork for trouble in our democracy, because you have both ends of monarchy, I guess, right? As you say, being the tyrant and being dependent on the tyrants.
You know, the thing is, the psychoanalyst Winnicott, whom I love, said that for democracy, you need mature interdependence. And that means you depend on others, but you are mature enough to know that you can't order them around. So you have to establish modes of conversation and reciprocity. But of course, that requires a mature personality. So he did think that individual maturity and social maturity went hand in hand. And I guess I think that's basically right, although we can use laws to reinforce good tendencies, and we don't have to have perfect people all the time. Of course, we wouldn't get them if we did want that.
You spend a lot of the book exploring the ways in which fear is related to other emotions we often think of as causing problems in our society. Anger, disgust, envy. Why is fear, in your view, the primary or underlying emotional driver?
Well, it's generally thought that it's the first emotion that infants feel, and that it's connected with more primitive parts of the brain and the amygdala, for example, and that it's a part of the brain that is very unconceptual and that belongs to all animals, not just the so-called higher animals. And the thing about fear is that, therefore, we don't always consult our thoughts when we have fear. It's more automatic. It needn't be, but we have to learn to temper it and to consult others, consult truth and evidence and so forth. But our initial instinct is just to run, and it's the useful instinct, because fear, obviously, without fear, we'd all be dead, because we get ourselves out of the way of cars, all the dangers of the modern world, through our fear. And it has to be instinctual to some extent, because we can't just stop and think, oh, shall I step out of the way of this car or not? But on the other hand, that pace of the reaction, and there are certain things that are really hardwired, the fear of objects rushing at us, the fear of snakes apparently is hardwired. So, you know, it goes before our rational thought. And that's less so with other emotions, such as anger, where usually you have to form a concept that somebody did something bad to you. So there's more thinking involved. And you know, primitive crying out is not the same thing, really, as anger. So the thing about fear, then, is it's very useful, and the rapidity of it is useful, but it can easily be hijacked for the wrong reasons. And we have to keep an eye on it more than on other emotions. Aristotle was very clear about this when he, in the Rhetoric, he spends a lot of time on fear as the expectation of danger. And he says, of course, it isn't just automatic. It is conceptual when we get to political life. But it can easily be manipulated by rhetoric. And he gives many, many examples of this. Because in thinking about the danger, we have to ask, first of all, how large is it? Second, how imminent is it? And third, how easy is it to avoid? And all of those things can be manipulated. So a politician, and of course he was advising politicians, who wants to make people afraid of something, their enemy, let's say, can easily represent that enemy as very, trouble using scary images. And of course, we know how often that happens.
Yes, I'm wondering if I should insert a soundbite here of they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats.
They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
Oh, right, right. I mean, of course, I have lots to say about that, because I must say, here he is in a country that tortures pigs and cows and so on, and he's worried entirely about certain animals who are cognitively just exactly similar to pigs. But anyway, that's the separate
point. We'll come back to that, yes.
We'll come back to that. But yes, I mean, these nightmare things have always been there, and horror movies are nothing new, and they're like a repository of images that we could use. The sudden danger that leaps out at you, let's say, comes across the border, or the danger that's characterized by somehow a different color or a different shape. And so all of those things, of course, the clever rhetorician, and, you know, a lot of political rhetoric is clever, if not correct, is used to make people afraid. Now, sometimes rhetoric can be very useful. I mean, imagine in some of these recent hurricanes that the governor of a state wants to make people evacuate, and they know it's pretty difficult to get people to leave their homes. So then scaring people by the size of the storm, look at this terrible storm. And of course, that is, in this case, based on truth. But representing it in a bad light can often give an extra oomph to the demand that people should evacuate, and that's very important. But often, it, of course, is used in ways that are racist, that are based on no facts at all, such as the connection between immigrants and crime. And so we have to watch out, because we can easily be hoodwinked.
We can be hoodwinked, and out of that fear comes anger. And that's one of the emotions that you say grows from fear. Babies may be born into a world of fear. How does anger come into it?
Okay, so then the baby makes a demand. I'm hungry, I want to be fed. Wah! And then sometimes the feeding happens as desired, but sometimes the guardian is distracted or doesn't feel like answering the baby right away. And then the baby begins to think, well, it's all about me. This world is all about me, because children are very narcissistic. And Freud called this infantile narcissism. And they think, well, it's all about me, and why is this person not ministering to my demands? And so the idea that I have rights and everyone should do what I want creeps in right away. And that's the kind of retributive anger. This person should be punished and made to suffer for not attending to my demands. And, of course, children are often very nasty to their parents. I remember when I was 3 years old and I was mad at my mother for not giving me something that I wanted. And I remember actually biting her. Now, of course, I remember it, because it shocked me. It shocked me as well as her. And I knew that it was wrong. And by that age, I already was troubled by this. And this is a good stage, because then you start thinking, what have I just done as a result of this anger? The world is not all about me, and I better think what I do to other people. But in any case, it is something that children are inclined to do, just striking out at somebody who doesn't give them what they want right now. And so this is part of the great challenge of parenting of all kinds, is to nourish the sense that you have to learn patience, you have to learn reciprocity, you have to understand that the person taking care of you also has needs, and you have to wait for the time when that person is not busy working or whatever the case may be. And usually, if the development goes well and the child isn't really being reared in an abusive way, this happens, and the child does learn patience and does learn to respect the needs of others. But the primitive sense of anger can still stick around. And I think, you know, anger is therefore also very easily manipulated. I think there's a kind of anger that's constructive, that says the world needs to be made better. This is outrageous. Now let's look at the world and let's change things. And that's the kind of anger that protest movements often use. So Martin Luther King Jr. said he thought that there were two different kinds of anger. The one kind that was backward-looking and retributive, and the other kind is forward-looking and constructive. And he wanted to nourish the second kind and not the first. And I have, in a or my more technical philosopher's way, I call the second kind transition anger, because it turns around and it moves to the future and it says, let's see what we can create. What can we do about this problem? But the backward-looking retributive kind is far more common. And when, you know, somebody loses a child or a friend to a crime, they don't think, usually, now how can I make fewer crimes, inflicting fewer parents? That would be the good way to think, because you can't bring the person back if the person is dead. But most often people think, now, that person has to suffer for what they've done, and they have to get the death penalty, because the death penalty is supported entirely by the thought of a life for a life, an eye for an eye, and the idea being that, all right, my child is dead. A kind of magical way of bringing the child back is to kill the one who killed the child. Much better if you were to just say, well, now let's see, what can I do about the future? An example of that. So drunk driving, of course, kills many people every day. And the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, I admire greatly, because instead of spending their lives trying to get capital punishment for the drunk drivers, they've gotten together to try to make things better for everyone in the future. So they have new heightened penalties for drunk driving, new customs, there must be a designated driver, and then new technology. So if you're sentenced to a DWI, you often have to blow into a tube before you can start your car, and that actually makes it impossible to commit that crime. So that's the kind of thing that would be a healthy reaction to the wrong that somebody else does you. But very often we don't do that. We just want to get the person who did it.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce this conversation. If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Martha Nussbaum, who is the author of many books, including from 2018, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. She is a professor at the University of Chicago. We're going to continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on Election Day, we're taking a step back to consider a deeper element of our politics, and that is the role of fear. Martha Nussbaum is a professor at the University of Chicago. In 2018, she published a book called The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. It is perhaps even more relevant today than when it first came out. I spoke with her by phone on Friday afternoon. Before the break, we talked about how fear is understood to be one of the first emotions most of us feel, and how it can lead to anger, and the ways that anger can drive us to seek people to blame. I first read The Monarchy of Fear 6 years ago. One of the points in the book I found most memorable was the way even our children's stories can reinforce this idea. Think of the Grimm's tales. Hansel and Gretel are targeted for being eaten by an evil witch in the woods. Red Riding Hood is attacked by a literal lone wolf. But Nussbaum suggests a different frame through which to think of these stories.
Well, I think these stories help us cope with the horrible things in life. That's their origin. But they often do it in a very unhelpful way. So you think about Hansel and Gretel. The real problem in that story, and I'm thinking particularly of the version that the opera is based on, but it's in most versions of the story, the real problem is poverty and hunger. The children don't have enough to eat, and then you remember what happens is they are dancing around and they spill the pail of milk, and so the mother gets furious at them and says, now you have to go out and get our food in the woods. And they go out into the woods. Well, that's the real problem. How can we deal with a world in which some people are so poor that they don't have enough to eat? And of course, they only got the milk because the father was just lucky, and he had a good day at the fair and sold all his brooms. So the children go out in the woods, and then the story pivots. And it's really not about hunger. It's all about this witch who wants to eat little children. And that's what the real danger is. It's not a political problem that needs to overhaul society to figure out how people get fed. No, it's this witch. And the minute we incinerate the witch, because, of course, it ends up the children push the witch oven, and right away all the children who've been turned into gingerbread people rise up and dance around. And it's very uncanny, because this was written by Engelbert Humperdinck, the opera, and he was a close friend of Wagner. And so when you see this ugly, hook-nosed woman being pushed into the oven, and then you see all these blonde-haired children dancing around, celebrating that, it certainly looks ahead to the Holocaust, I would say, and the idea that somebody ugly is the one who's really causing our problems. And now we just have to get the ugly person and not fix the problem. So that is what I see in that story. And a lot of fairy tales are like that.
A lot of fairy tales are like that, where, yes, because same thing with the big bad wolf. It's not, it could be a story about lack of care for the elderly, and for example, yes.
Right. Yeah, she's going to visit her grandmother because her grandmother is far away and is not doing very well. And so then that's, again, starts with a real human problem that all societies have. And then it pivots, and all of a sudden it's not the grandmother's age and needs, but it's about this big bad wolf who's going to eat little children. And it's so ingrained in our psychology that big animals are fearful. And as I said, I think part of that is evolutionary. And so in that case, too, it makes us misidentify the real problem. And I think this comes up in politics all the time. So we have, you know, every society has economic problems and problems of crime and so forth. But instead of thinking, what is the structure of this problem, where does it really come from, and how will we fix it, the stories often pivot to some demon, let's say immigrants, who in statistics commit fewer crimes than the average person in the population. That's we might expect, because obviously if they're undocumented, they don't want to get caught. And so they try to behave in a way that, you know, keeps them away from the notice of the police. But the story is, oh, there is a problem. And if we keep this horde of immigrants out, then the problem of poverty and labor and so on will be fixed. When, of course, really, the problem we have is a shortage of unskilled labor. And so it's likely to make that problem worse.
People will be hearing this conversation on Election Day.
Oh, God.
So why, and that gets at the bigger point here, why is fear is dangerous for all forms of government, or it can be. Why is it uniquely dangerous for democratic self-governance?
Well, I think it's because that's the one form where everyone has to be a little bit more mature. You can't just depend on the autocrat to take care of you, nor can you be an autocrat ordering other people around. But you have to have what Winnicott called mature interdependency. And so the problem is that getting people to go out to vote is often hard. People in America usually don't like to vote, and they're a little bit casual about it. Other countries have mandatory voting, or they have a holiday on Election Day, but we don't, and therefore it is hard to motivate people to go out and vote. And both parties, in different ways, are using fear to get people to go out to vote. And the fear of immigrants or women or on one side, but the fear of the loss of democracy on the other side. Now, that one of the fears may be better founded than the other, I think, definitely so. But at the same time, it's better to motivate people by the appeal of constructive policies, if you can do it. But if you're desperate to get people to go to the polls, it's very easy to fall back on the fear card.
Because fear is a greater motivator than constructive policies, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you just have a policy debate and you say this is the best way to solve the problem of healthcare or whatever, people think, well, it's a busy day, got a lot of work to do, why should I go vote? Now, unfortunately, I think at this last minute, when people are trying to really motivate people, they're all using the fear card. LeBron James, whom I greatly admire, he made a very good statement. I mean, he is focusing not on concrete policy issues, but on demonization of Trump, which is well-founded in many ways. But, you know, it's, again, the fear card that is being played. And I think it would be better, although right now, very important to get everyone to go out and vote, we're going to see a lot more use of the fear card.
What is the alternative to fear and anger as a motivating force in politics? Because fear works, right? Practical political operatives will say, we do this because we know it works.
Well, I think some elections, and quite a lot of elections, are there are substantive policy issues that divide the two sides. And I think it used to be that the difference between Democrats and Republicans was largely around substantive policy issues. Just think back to the era of Mitt Romney or John McCain and so forth. And then you see that, that they were treating, they were not playing the fear card. They had concrete policy objectives, and they were different from those of the Democrats. So I think that things used to be much healthier. But now that the concrete policies have basically left the stage, and we have people like Liz Cheney, who, of course, differs in most policy respect from Kamala Harris, siding with her, and very emphatically so, and thinking of focusing on the fear that Trump presents. Now, of course, Trump then turns around and says this terrible thing, that he'd like to see Liz Cheney looking into the barrel of a gun. And whether he, I think he didn't know what he meant. Did he mean a firing squad? Did he mean war or whatever? But in any case, he just ups the ante in terms of fear-inspiring rhetoric. So that is not healthy. And I think, you know, maybe parliamentary democracies are a little better able to resist this, partly because the policies are, the campaigns are less about individuals and more about parties with clearly defined differences. So if you're a Tory in Great Britain, you know that that stands for something, and it's different from what the Labour Party stands for. And it is a policy-driven way of doing elections. And I think that's all for the good. But, of course, those countries get increasingly drawn into the U.S. orbit, and you get characters singling themselves out from the party and making the election all about them, like Boris Johnson was very good at doing. So I don't know. You know, it's a very difficult thing to run a democracy, and the Greeks knew that very well. In fact, they represent in their literature the ways that democracies can be taken over by demagogues. Thucydides describes a debate where the demagogue Cleon made people completely change their mind about a policy that they voted on by using fear rhetoric. So what happened was the decision had been that they were going to kill all the people from the rebelling colony of Milos. And this is what Cleon wanted them to do. He whipped up anger and fear, and a ship was sent out to kill all these people. Then a more calm and deliberative politician, Diodotus, stepped forward and says, you know, Cleon has manipulated you, referring to your fear and to your anger. And he's made you do something that was not wise, and it just doesn't make sense to kill all these, to kill all the men and enslave the women and children. And so stop it. Vote the other way. And so then they voted the other way, but the ship that was going to kill all these people had already left. So by sheer chance, that ship was becalmed at sea, and therefore they had sent out another ship to overtake the first one. That other ship managed to overtake the first one just by sheer chance. And for that reason, so many men were not killed, so many women and children were not put into slavery. So, you know, it just shows you how irrational demagogues can make you do things you quickly come to regret, but you don't always get a second chance.
You don't. And there was no Fox News in ancient Greece.
Well, you know, I think what they, what reading Thucydides tells you is it wasn't so different. Of course, the population was smaller, so they could all be in person hearing Cleon. And so it's different here, just largely because of the size and the quickness of news spreading. But it's the same human phenomenon.
Yes. Well, your talk of big you know, sort of big picture solutions, parliamentary democracy, maybe proportional representation, we could talk about in a different context, are music to my ears. But in The Monarchy of Fear, you also focus on individual action and ways that we can try to countervail the force of fear in our politics. One of them is following the examples of Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. You say separating the doer from the deed, embracing the humanity in others while protesting the wrongs they may have committed. Thinking of our fellow citizens as friends, which lays the groundwork for making common cause with opponents. What if one's opponents do not want to make common cause?
Well, even so, I think you can struggle on ahead, and some of them will listen to you. After 9/11, that was a real firestorm of fear, if that is not too mixed a metaphor. And, you know, we were all terrified, and it would have been so easy for a mass slaughter of Muslim citizens or non-citizens to take place. But here, I quoted from some speeches of George W. Bush. He was very good there at calming people down. If the person in authority says, look here, we have to separate the person who did this from the whole of this state and this group of people, and we must not equate the one with the other. And he said this again and again and again. Then some people are really going to listen to that, particularly if the person is a person in authority and says it in a very definitive way. So I think it makes a great deal of difference who's in the office of the presidency and what kind of rhetoric they choose and how they motivate the population.
Well, we do not yet know who will be, what kind of person will be in the office of the presidency. One of the prescriptions you have, though, as you say, you know, refusing payback, looking to the future with hope. This book came out 6 years ago. I wonder, in the intervening time, are you more or less hopeful about the future? How do you think about that? How has your thinking been affected by this continuation of this time we've lived through?
Well, you know, I'm lucky enough to be thinking not only about the U.S., where I do feel things have gotten considerably worse. I think the Republican Party has gone past the point of no return now. There's no way I can see it getting back to the days of Cheney and his daughter, whom I really admire, and, you know, disagree with, of course, on almost everything. But there are other countries, and I've worked a lot on India, and the Modi autocracy had made such progress in extinguishing freedom of the press, extinguishing academic freedom, that everyone I know, including my own collaborator, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen, said it's just too late. It's not going to come back, or at least, as Amartya said, who turned 90 this year, not in my lifetime. Well, the election came, and democracy prevailed because Modi was, his bid for supermajority lost out completely, and he was forced to govern in a coalition. And it's now a totally different world in Indian politics. He's still the prime minister, but he's on a very, very short leash. And so what happened there? People really looked at the facts. And they, even though the freedom of the press had been pretty substantially extinguished, it's hard to completely do that these days with social media and the internet. So people were energetic, and they gathered the facts. And they went to the polls in large numbers, and they delivered a negative verdict on his autocracy. So, you know, people are very surprising. They can listen much more than you think they're going to listen, and they can take things that you don't think they're going to take. Nations go in both directions. Now, of course, I talk about, as you mentioned, Nelson Mandela. And at that time, who would have thought that South Africa would become a thriving parliamentary democracy? But now that nation is deeply troubled, largely because it hasn't been able to fix its economic problems and its problems of crime. So nations go up and they go down, and I think there's no point of no return, really. And so we just have to hope that we would, at some point, I would like to see us get back to the place where we were when we had John McCain leading one party and Obama leading the other party.
We need to take another break. More from my conversation with the philosopher Martha Nussbaum when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we are listening to a conversation I taped on Friday with Martha C. Nussbaum, the noted philosopher and longtime professor at the University of Chicago. We began today by talking about The Monarchy of Fear, a philosopher looks at her political crisis, which is a book she published in 2018. Still relevant today. I did also want to talk about one of her more recent works, and that is Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility. She wrote this book more recently, over the course of many years, though. It came out in 2022, and in it, she argues that we as human beings need to take animal rights much more seriously than we already do. This is a philosophical and legal treatise, sort of looking at how we might go about achieving that. I want to turn now to Justice for Animals. Can I ask you to begin by telling us a little bit about Rachel?
Oh, sure. Well, yes, it was her birthday yesterday. She would have been 52 years old, so she's been dead for 5 years. But anyway, yes, she was a wonderful, wonderful daughter, my only child, and she was a lawyer for animal rights. She worked for an NGO called Friends of Animals. But because she had a PhD and had been briefly an academic before she went to law school, she also loved to write articles. And so we got into this pattern of writing articles together where she would supply the law and the facts and I would supply the philosophy. And we wrote 5 articles together and presented them at the Human Development and Capability Association, which is this interdisciplinary association that Amartya Sen and I founded. So anyway, she was just my buddy in that respect, and meanwhile working for this NGO, which focused on the problems of wild animals. She was particularly interested in whales, not that she could do cases involving whales because it was an American NGO, but she just knew a lot about legal issues regarding whales. So that's what we often wrote about, because she adored whales. And in fact, she wanted her ashes scattered in the place in the San Juan Islands where the orcas swim. And I wrote a piece about that, actually, in the New York Review of Books last year. So if you look up where the orcas swim in the New York Review of Books, you'll see at the end something about our family memorial service. Anyway, she had a transplant operation. It was successful, but then she got a fungal infection that could not be cured, and she died of that in December 2019. And at that point, I was already embarked on writing the book. I had showed her some chapters. We had lots of conversations with her about the shape of the book. But, of course, it was the most terrible and devastating blow. I mean, just the worst possible thing that I can imagine. I always thought, of course, that she would mourn for me. And here I was having to figure out how to mourn for her. And her husband, of course, was there too. And he now lives with me. And he's a great comfort, and we comfort each other. But another thing I did was just to pour all my energy into the writing of this book. Because I thought, okay, she's gone, but I can do something. I can't bring her back, but I can make her ideas have more power in the world and do something about that. And so I spent, the book came out in January 2023, so I spent all the intervening time making that book as good as it could be, learning a huge amount about different kinds of animals. What I'm trying to do is to recommend a new framework, because I'm a philosopher, I'm not a scientist, a new framework, but very much informed by current science, for thinking about what our goals should be when we think about non-human animals.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I will say I'm very sorry for your loss. I do want to ask, what, before we get to the framework, what had been your orientation toward animals before she began work in that area?
Oh, I had always been concerned with animals, but not so centrally in terms of my work. In my 2006 book, Frontiers of Justice, I already did have a compressed version of the argument of the book. So for a long time, I've been thinking about using my capabilities approach as a framework for animal rights. In terms of my personal life, because I travel a lot and because I think it's bad to keep a dog in an apartment, however nice, when you were traveling a lot and you would have to have a different person walk the dog all the time and so forth. And I think a lot of companion animals are under-exercised and under-stimulated. I don't actually live with an animal, but I adore animals, and I visit them whenever I can. I have lots of friend animals that are owned, so-called, by other people, and I'm particularly interested in wild animals. I've been on eco safari in Botswana to see elephants in particular, but other animals too, and I particularly got keen. I guess I had focused on elephants in my life, and that was my wild animal of choice, and I know quite a lot about the plights of elephants. But Rachel got me to take a great deal of interest in whales, and so now I'm pursuing that even more. So I've been whale watching in U.S., and then last summer and last August, my son-in-law and I went to Alaska. We went whale watching in Alaska. So anyhow, which animals is the change? But animals have always been something of importance to me. I did live with an animal when I was much younger, but that was when I had a backyard. I could just let the dog out, and the dog could run around the backyard. And that's not the kind of life I have in Chicago now.
Mm. So near the beginning of the book, you write, "The extent of our own implication and practices that harm animals should make every person with a conscience consider what we can all do to change this situation." So make that case. Why is animal welfare our collective responsibility?
Well, I mean, of course, it's certain responsibilities can be assigned to an individual. Like if an animal lives in your house, you've undertaken to bring that animal into your house, and you have special responsibilities for the well-being of that animal, and law should hold you accountable if that animal is abused or neglected, just the way they would with a child. But most animals are not like that. They live either in our city, but not in a particular person's house, like birds and coyotes and so forth, or they're so-called wild animals that cross boundaries of nation and don't particularly fall even under the jurisdiction of any one nation. So how do we think of the responsibilities? If we think that, well, the first question is, what's the goal? And that's what most of the book is about. If the goal is not just to cease pain, which is what the utilitarians say, and I think that's important and it's great, but it doesn't go far enough, because animals are not just suffering pain at our hands. They're also suffering deprivation of movement, free movement. An animal in a zoo is being imprisoned, in effect, and it has no freedom to move. And they're suffering in many ways. Their form of life is being deformed by the things that we do. So, I mean, let me fill in that a little bit before I go back to why it's a collective responsibility. Think about whales. Okay, so in the oceans, there are hundreds and hundreds of tons by now of plastic that have been put there by careless humans. Plastic bottles, single-use items, are almost never really recycled. They end up in the ocean. And just as one example of what can happen to a whale, they eat this plastic because it looks very attractive, and then it sits in their stomach because they can't digest it. And in the end, they die of starvation because they can't find room for any other kind of food. There are many other things that they suffer in the ocean. So, for example, container ships make a terrible racket that spook the whales and cause the disruption of their mating practices and their migration practices. And there are all kinds of sonic disruptions. That infects their way of life in a way that doesn't exactly cause physical pain, but it causes the total deformation of a way of life. Their stress hormones can be measured, and we can see. One very interesting thing that was found was during COVID, when container shipping came ground to a halt for a while, the measurable stress hormones of whales dropped because that source of stress wasn't there for a while. Anyway, so if we think of the goal, and this is what I try to argue, is not just the reduction of the physical pain we cause to animals, but the giving each animal a chance to live the kind of life that's characteristic of that kind of animal. And this is where I use the idea of capabilities, that is substantive opportunities to choose what's important to you. If that's the goal, and that's what I'm trying to argue, what could we do? Well, it matters a lot where the animal is, whether nation-based policy can do any good. But the worst problem is coordinating all the nations. So we have to say, first of all, what happens to the whales is bad. Now, whose responsibility is it? Well, it looks like it's hard to say. It's the Americans, it's the Germans, or whatever. It's all of us who must band together and take responsibility for doing something about this problem. And that means it's what Kant called imperfect right. They have a right, but it's imperfect in the sense that we can't say clearly who has the duty corresponding to the right. So what we have to say is it's a collective obligation.
I think it was the critic Timothy Morton who, you know, used this phrase or coined this term hyperobject to describe problems that are so vast in space and time that people almost can't comprehend them. And global warming is sort of the classic example, right? It's all around us. It's nowhere. You can't touch it. You can't see it necessarily. I wonder what hope do you have? We have been so paralyzed and unable to come to any sort of agreement internationally or even domestically on an issue like that, where at least it's talked about a lot, people are aware of it. What hope could there be? How do you begin to turn the dial, so to speak, for people to begin to take animal welfare as seriously as they take their own, or maybe half as seriously as they take their own? Because it seems a lot of people don't even take their own welfare all that seriously.
Well, no, I think people are very selfish. They want not just meat, they want cheap meat. And that is a huge problem. But first of all, I think thinking it's too vast is a recipe for disaster, because you think, oh, it's so vast, it's all around us, therefore I give up, I can't do anything about it. No, everyone who listens to this can do something. You can adopt a shelter animal, you can show your children pictures of animals and talk to them. There are so many things that people can do. You can even just refuse to use single-use plastic, and you can campaign for different laws in your own community with regard to single-use plastic. So any person can do many, many things. But the other thing is that, luckily, the greed motive, which is so powerful, we're coming, in a way, to the end of that, I think. Think about whaling. People loved harpooning whales because all the lamps in Europe and America were lit by whale oil. They needed that oil. Now, harpooning ceased, and we're beginning to be able to get on top of that horrible industry because the whale oil is no longer needed, and the whale meat is actually not very useful, and so on. So even the King of England was able to be crowned with olive oil from his family's vineyards. King Charles insisted on that instead of whale oil, which was customary. But, you know, the thing about meat is we can now synthesize, and of course the plant-based meat has become very popular, much more than people expected. But if you don't like that, we now can synthesize so-called real meat from stem cells. And the meat industry is terrified of this. They're trying to block it. But they can't block science for very long. It's there. It's already, you can purchase such meat in Singapore. So what's needed is for it to be marketed and scaled up so that the price will be within people's reach. But I think we're already in that era now where people will have other options. If you can choose between a hamburger made without cruelty and a hamburger made with cruelty, what are you going to choose? And it's a low-cost decision. And that's what we think we're about to get to, is making it a low-cost decision.
Martha Nussbaum, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation a lot.
As did I. Martha Nussbaum is a philosopher, a distinguished professor at the University of Chicago. Her books include Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis, and her most recent book. It's actually not even out yet. It's coming out next week. It's called The Tenderness of Silent Minds, Benjamin Britten and His War Requiem. We talked a little bit about it in our conversation. We don't have time to air it today. Let me know if that's something you want us to revisit on the program. Talk at 21stshow.org is the way to get in touch. That's all we have for today. The polls are open until 7 p.m. Go vote. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.